Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 363. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com, strolling over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter, the handle is thisshowissogay, and of course, go on over to that Facebook, type in thisshowissogay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. What an exciting week to be here in Cleveland, but there actually are other things going on in the world other than all of these folks who have come to visit us for a few days here in Cleveland. And with that, I bring to you our guest for this week. Let me introduce her. Reverend Irene Monroe is an award-winning speaker, theologian, radio personality, writer, and so much more. Irene does a weekly Monday segment, All Revved Up, on WGBH 89.7 FM on Boston Public Radio, and a weekly Friday segment, What's Up, on New England Channel News. She's a Huffington Post blogger and a syndicated religion columnist. Her columns appear in 23 cities across the country and in the UK and Canada. She writes a weekly column in the Boston Home LGBTQ newspaper, Bay Windows. Recognition for Irene's work includes just so many different things, but I'll say a few. The 2015 Top 25 LGBT Power Players of New England Award by Boston Spirit Magazine, and the Open Door Award for work with HIV and AIDS, Black Church and LGBTQ Community. She was a recipient of the 2013 Bayard Rustin Service Award and a GLAAD 2012 Spirit of Justice Awardee. She appears in the film For the Bible Tells Me So, and she was profiled in the Gay Pride episode of In the Life, an Emmy-nominated segment. She has pages and pages more to her stunning resume, but if I read them, we won't have time to actually speak. So let's just say, Irene Monroe, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
I'm delighted to be invited.
Irene, that's all the time we have for this week's show, just with that bio.
You're too kind.
It was great stuff. Now, we have so much ground to cover. Are you ready?
Okay, let's go.
I said at the top of your bio, speaker, theologian, radio personality, writer, is there one identity that you gravitate more towards than the others?
No, I don't. You know what? I think what you learn is that, and you can certainly resonate with me, we live at the intersections of our identities. And I think a lot of times that will sort of shape our calling as well as the work we do. So for instance, Ken, I know that you are a professor, but you're also a radio host.
Yeah.
And a lot of that, I presume, I'm being presumptuous, as you well know, has a lot to do with realizing that even though you're speaking to the academy, you also have to speak to a particular demographic group that could benefit, like a show, This Is So Gay.
Yeah. Yeah, you just used that word calling, and it strikes me in looking at the work that you do, there's no way to do this work without you having some sort of moment, I would imagine a series of moments of calling. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the interesting thing is that when I say calling, and I am talking about one's vocation, we think of it within a religious context, but we all are called. You know, those of us who are certainly engaged in social justice, when I define my social justice as a faith that is defined within the context of social justice, and I presume people who don't, you know, are tied to a church or a religious background do their calling in relationship to a deep-held belief that they carry with them. So it's a deep-held belief. And certainly some of my calling is shaped certainly by the African-American church experience, my own personal experience, being a sister outsider, meaning in terms of a sister knocking on the Black church door that doesn't accept, even in 2016, the totality of its and gifts of its LGBT community. I need to qualify that. They accept our gifts. They just don't want us to be open about it, because on any church Sunday morning, you could not have the kind of Black gospel music that you hear were it not for all of us, and especially the boys, in the choir loft.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my gosh, I have so many different directions I want to go with you. I barely know what to do. Let me pick one. Was there a defining Irene Monroe moment where you just knew that this is my work? This is what I'm here to do.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, a very interesting thing. And I think what it was when I decided that I wanted to go to seminary, it really made sense to me, being African-American, that I would apply to African-American seminaries, because who best can educate me about the Black church than a Black seminary, right?
Which, yeah.
That seems logical. But I did, but I didn't get in to the very two seminaries that I thought I would, which was, you know, ITC down in Atlanta, which is Interdenominational Theological Seminary. And I didn't get into Howard School of Theology. And one could say, well, you didn't get in maybe because of your grades, but I don't think that was the case, because Union Theological Seminary took me, Princeton. I mean, I got acceptance at Princeton, Harvard, yeah, you know, all of those places. But then one finally said to me that they didn't accept me. I was provisional. They didn't accept me because of my faith statement. And my faith statement is, I talked about, I used Apostle Paul's statement that there was a thorn in his side. And I said that the thorn in the African American church's side is its homophobia, and how it has shaped a down-low culture that not only impacts its LGBT community, but the entire community. Because as we learn that the new face of AIDS, we thought, you know, folks thought it was just going to be a gay disease. But as we learn, before the CDC actually came out with its report, because those of us who were in the African-American community knew that African-American straight women were dying from AIDS.
You know, I have to tell you, it's really hard for me to even wrap my mind around the seminary piece. My partner is starting seminary in the fall, and watching his process, I mean, look, I'm a gay Jew from New Jersey. What do I know about seminary? But watching his process of getting rejected by an academic institution, which maybe that's where I trip up a little bit. I see them primarily as academic institutions, but having an academic institution write in their acceptance letter, I'm sorry, you cannot be accepted here because marriage is between a man and a woman. It's just hard for me to wrap my mind around. I think that's maybe the sheltered academic in me.
No, yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, the whole idea, when we think of universities, we think of them as a marketplace of ideas, right?
Yeah.
An exchange going on. And particularly when we think of liberal institutions, more so than, you know, I know this without knowing your partner. He's not applying to Moody Bible School, you know what I mean?
Right.
Which makes it very, very clear, or Liberty University. So you always are a bit taken aback when they purport to be open and affirming in terms of creative ideas, and yet here comes a person who's LGBTQ not accepting them. And what happens with that is that, you know, a school that is always, you know, the academy is always about a new body of information. You know this as an academician. What, you know, and what we bring is a different perspective, a different, what we would call epistemology, you know, social location, in terms of how we center not only our lived experience, but how we shape a particular canon within an already established discipline.
Right. And so to present it at this as this very, to me, and again, I'm all for speaking from the eye, false choice between your sexual orientation and your faith, it's just, again, so hard for me to wrap my mind around.
Oh, well, absolutely. You know, because the whole idea about, you know, about church is that all are welcome as is. Now, there's no church that doesn't do that. You know, I mean, purports to espouse that. But it's very, very interesting how they don't live up to that, to their purported faith statement.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And I think what troubles me more so now in 2016, particularly with last year's decision, federal decision, and thank God, around same-sex marriage, you wonder now, what is the stubbornness, or, you know,
right,
of not moving forward? We see in certain circles, and a lot more, the acceptance of LGBT people in all sectors of society. A great move just was made here in Massachusetts around trans bathroom bills.
Yeah.
And the Army just accepted, I think it was last month, mm-hmm. transgendered servicemen and women. So, you know, you begin to wonder what exactly is religion then about?
Right.
When the state can move on it, when you expect the last place to do it, when the federal government can move on it, you wonder then what are you holding on to? And how do you plan to sustain your ministry and really without opening up to LGBT people?
Yeah.
I always used to argue that what keeps marriage alive, because as we knew and still is today, 50% of all heterosexuals are divorced. If you want this institution to thrive, I think you should open the doors to us.
What are we keeping sacred here, right? It's not even just the what is the stubbornness, but it's almost as if there's a presentation somewhere that there's something to be gained by keeping this scope so narrow. And that's what's so hard.
Right. And then to use what we call, what is they call, restoration, these religious freedom bills
right.
that have been passed in a number of states that, oh, Kim Davis is a good example of it. This is the woman in Kentucky, if you remember,
yeah.
who would not issue wouldn't issue marriage license to same-sex couples. And her contention was that her faith prohibited her to do so. And then you talk about, and she said, you know, it would pretty much be desecrating the sanctity of marriage. And no one to me, you know, desecrated it more than the, what, four or five marriages she had and extramarital affairs
right.
that she had.
Right.
The hypocrisy.
It's unbelievable.
It's too enormous.
It's unbelievable. And by the way, listeners, just so everybody knows, we're talking about a Republican governor of Massachusetts who signed this into law. We really can cross party lines to advance equalities. It can happen. It can absolutely happen.
Oh, absolutely. We had to shame our governor, but yes, we got him to move on it.
There you go. I'm all for, hey, look, again, Gay Jew from Jersey, I can do shame-based. That's fine by
okay.
me. I endorse it. I endorse
all
it.
Right.
Well, I have been reading your writing for so long. You wrote this at one point. You wrote, quote, racism continues to be one of those nagging problems that we must grapple with as part of an ongoing dialogue that sometimes appears to get better. Talks concerning race in America never succeed at making people of color feel secure or making the problem seem curable. Now, here's the problem, Irene. Whereas some people might think, oh, the Reverend Irene Monroe, she just wrote that last week. You wrote that in 2003. What does it mean
yeah.
that you wrote that 13 years ago and you can easily read that and think, well, she just wrote that the other day?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, one of the things we could say is that the more things change, the more they remain the same.
Right.
But that's one. I have to say that from 2003 to now, we have a better way to talk about racism. And we have a better way to talk about racism. And one of the ways is that we have talked about whiteness studies and a number of sort of allies around this issue have begun to do the kind of self-introspection that is needed to look at white privilege and how that permeates in all facets of life that they just weren't cognizant of. We have now a lot of white allies tackling this issue in a way that, 13 years ago, it was just, again, a thorn in everyone's side, but no one wanted to talk about it. So I think a lot more of our white allies have come out of the closet, whether they're straight or gay, but a lot more, believe it or not, within our LGBT community, because I think they understand more so, really, about what it is to live at these intersections. And where LGBT folks, white ones in particular, understood that they were oppressed around their sexual orientation and gender identity, many got it that, oh, yeah, I do have white privilege.
Yeah. Yeah. It is such an interesting intersection. And I actually usually ban the word interesting from my students, but it's my radio show and I can say it right now. It's such a fascinating, stimulating intersection because as a college professor who teaches race, right? Like most of my courses are about race. This is what I do. I think that the being gay part gets me in the door in a way that some of my straight white colleagues maybe can't get in the same way, which is always, that's another piece that sometimes I struggle with.
Yeah, no, I agree. I guess it would, I would surmise it would get you in the door with a lot more credibility because you come from a struggling community
right.
of people. And so even though, you know, you might identify as a white male, but you're a white gay male.
Right.
That's a signal. And that's why it's important to have that sort of building of coalition, because while you might complain about and talk about what it is to be a white straight male, that doesn't preclude you in my dialogue or to shut down when I talk about what it's like to be a Black African-American woman, lesbian woman in society. It, in many ways, it opens you to an air of compassion, of understanding people's individual struggles.
Yeah. Again, listeners, we are here with speaker, theologian, radio personality, writer, Irene Monroe. Now, I don't know if you know this, Reverend, but there's a lot going on in the U.S. right now with regards to race. Not sure if you've heard. I really do want to start from a place of just pausing for a second and asking, as I think we all need to be asking each other, how are you?
Well, anxious. Very, very anxious.
Yeah.
More so, it's very, very interesting because I keep asking folks, are we more sort of like on the edge around racial issues in 2016 than clearly when, you know, we were growing up or we hear our parents talk about the civil rights movement? Are we more violent around this issue than what, the, what, 40s, 50s, and 60s? It's really astonishing.
Yeah.
And disturbing. And I move with a lot of trepidation, not only for myself, but for my partner as well, which is what brings us together, you know, at this moment because of a piece that I wrote saying, you know, white LGBT people, you know, we need your help with police harassment.
Yeah. You wrote in that piece, you wrote, "The queer politics of discussing race in the LGBTQ community is as unresolved among us as within the dominant culture. However, unlike the larger culture, white LGBTQs can offer advice to communities of color from their own experiences of abuse by law enforcement officers, including discrimination, harassment, profiling, entrapment, and victimization that's often ignored and based on our actual or perceived sexual orientations and gender identities." First of all, can we just pause for a second? I would like to again say I'm obsessed with your writing. Your power of the pen gets right to the heart of it every time I read your words. So first, there's that.
Thank you. You're terribly kind.
No problem. That's so. That. This you. Is from you. These are your words. Now, the issue is, though, you would not need to write a piece saying we need your help if that help was overwhelmingly there. Is that fair to say? Is that an uncharacterization?
That's right. That's absolutely right. Because and the thing that really puzzled me about this is that as a society, I think that we speak up about certain oppressions in society, or we claim them and we'll speak about them, and they're divided in terms of our demographic groups or how we identify. So let me give you an example here.
Yes.
Of what I mean. In 1998, I'll always remember that was a very difficult year in America, another one in America. In, I think it was June of that year, place that I had never heard of, Jasper, Texas, an African-American man named James Byrd.
Yeah.
Was dragged to his death simply because he was Black by a bunch of white, really, thugs who took advantage of this lone Black man on the road. But the interesting thing about it, so you got the African-American community up in arms and shouting, and you even had folks like Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton and, you know, all the folks who come out, right? But then later that year, in October, another place at least I never heard of, so it makes talk about how geographically limited I am, but a place called Laramie, Wyoming, I never heard of, but a young gay white student named, as we all know, Matthew, was killed because he was gay. And it was very interesting, of course, the LGBT community, predominantly white, jumped up. But then I'm thinking, so now where Where are the activists? Where's you know, where's Jesse, I was saying, and Al Sharpton? Why don't we see the interconnections of these oppressions, and particularly for people who live at the intersection? It was very, very interesting to hear Alveda King, the conservative, and I have to say, niece of Martin Luther King, who said gays didn't have to sit at the back of the bus. And so that really shows you how society sees certain demographic groups in their silos and not at the intersection. Because the truth is that if you were a black gay person, you sat in the back of the bus too. It also showed how, when we think of the African-American civil rights movement, we automatically think of, you know, Martin Luther King or maybe Ralph Abernathy and even maybe Jesse, but we don't automatically think of Bayard Rustin, who was the architect of the actual March on Washington and had to intentionally take a back seat to what was going on, although he was the architect of the march. So that was it. I'm saying that what happens is that we don't see the we set up what I can best depict as a hierarchy of oppression. And I would describe that as quickly as I can to your audience. It's this notion that your oppression, whatever that is, far greater than anyone else's, as opposed to seeing the interconnections of that, of those oppressions, so that we can see the full tapestry of humanity, not just one demographic group that identifies with this.
Yeah, I will admit my privilege in a heartbeat on this show and in class and anywhere I can. When you say 1998, I go straight to Matthew Shepard. There's no pause. There's no other moment of that anything else happened. And that's part of this narrative.
Right. And the interesting thing is that we got a hate bill, crimes bill out of it. And it's called the James Byrd, Matthew Shepard hate crimes bill. But you're absolutely right. People forget that narrative. And a lot of times what happened is because not only the way that certain demographic groups look at race or look at sexual orientation, it's also sometimes how media reports it, because we call it that bill, the Matthew Shepard hate crime bill. But it's the full title of it is really the James Byrd, Matthew Shepard hate crime bill. And we also have to address the fact that many in the African-American community were mad and upset that if there was going to be a hate crime bill, that they were going to affix such a bill to a black man.
Yeah.
That also had a lot to do with why you had black ministers during the our struggle around same-sex marriage and our struggle around Proposition 8 and all of that, with the whole idea that claiming that race is the ultimate oppression and ignoring how that sort of, you know, branches out to different groups of people.
Yeah. Well, here's my problem with Reverend Irene Monroe, and obviously I have no problems with you, and I think you're wonderful, but if I were to have a problem, it would be this one. So I'm going to read the last sentence of this piece in The Advocate, and again, I encourage everybody to check it out. You can easily find it. We'll link to it. White LGBTs, we need your help with police harassment. I don't want to ruin the ending, but I am going to read the last sentence. You wrote, "I'm calling on my white LGBTQ brothers and sisters for help because my spouse and I don't know where our black bodies are safe in this country." And here's the problem. I read a sentence like that and I immediately want to spring into action. And I want to go straight to that word help and figure out what is it that I can do. But the problem comes in, I don't want to turn to Reverend Irene Monroe and say, what should I do? Right? Because that perpetuates this whole process where we have to put people of color in the position of saying, and tell me what to do. You're experiencing this discrimination, you're experiencing all of this horridness, and you also have to tell me how to help. That doesn't feel right either.
Right, and we also had to do it as LGBT folks, right?
Yes.
We know that, because the oppressor is always teaching the oppressor,
right?
And stuff, absolutely. And so absolutely, and one of the things that you know, troubled me about this is like, come on now, LGBT community, particularly, you know, because, you know, the whole idea of our modern LGBT movement was sparked by a homophobic police raid. We know it as Stonewall, right?
Yeah.
And so it's like, as LGBT people, we know about profiling. We know about police harassment, you know, based on our actual or perceived sexual orientation and gender identities. So I'm sitting here, you know, and I'm thinking, come on now, we're not the only one that has had this problem and continue to have this problem. And so the call, the charge, is really asking the larger LGBT community to talk about, to get involved around policing in their communities, because change happens on a local level.
Yeah.
And we live more integrated, believe it or not. You wouldn't think so if you're looking at the RNC convention last night, but we are more integrated than clearly we were even 10 years ago. But it's important to look and raise questions about, how is policing done in my community? How might we improve on what we already have? And I think that, you know, we talk about the culture of policing, and I know that some of us live in homogeneous communities, but even in those communities, it raises some questions, because there's always a group that is an outsider. And so whatever that group is, an outsider in your community, it helps you then to build not only a compassionate ear, but a sort of real lived, you know, experience of activism towards changing policing in your local community.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I don't know if you know this as well, Reverend, but this is emotional work. I think you know that. I think that that's something that you're well familiar with. How do we, you know, so many of our brothers and sisters are so incapacitated by their emotions that taking that first step towards helping is such a colossally huge step. How do we counsel them through the myriad emotions that can incapacitate towards actually taking some action?
First of all, you always need a community. You cannot do this work alone, because it will kill your soul. It really will. And you will turn inward as opposed to outward and affecting change. But I always say that it's important to find out, for instance, you know, certainly I have a bully pulpit, whether it's Sunday morning at church or writing. But I think that there are other ways that people can find how to affect change. So some folks are musicians. Some folks are involved in their local politics. I think that it's always important that whatever is your interest within your community, to work at changing that and getting more people involved in it. I don't think that your best work is done when you think that you can do it alone and you think that being angry is the best way to, or acting out is the best way to do it.
Right. Right. Well, I have to seek some advice from you because I have you on the air right now. I am performing my first wedding in a few months. Give me some tips. What should I do?
Oh my God, this is absolutely wonderful. Okay. You know, congratulations. It's such a great honor.
I'm so excited, and you do it so well. So you got to tell me, what do I need to be doing?
I tell you, it'll come from the heart, because it's, you know, every wedding is different. It's not a template, believe it or not. And so I take it that you perhaps have counseled the couple. You know a little bit about the couple. You know if they're writing vows. Are they writing their own vows?
Okay, I see that I have some questions to ask. Good. What else should I know?
Well, I mean, what do you do? What you're doing is preparing the liturgy.
Yes.
You're preparing a liturgy, a wedding liturgy. That's the part where, you know, the invocation, who's speaking, the blessings, and then it helps you once you know what selections have been chosen in terms of maybe poems or statements that people from the wedding party want to say during the wedding, help shape your little homily to the couple, as well as your blessing that you will be offering them.
Okay. This was the part of the show where Reverend Irene Monroe reminded me that perhaps I have some work to do and shouldn't just wing it. So that's good. That was a good reminder, and I needed it.
Okay. And also, when we get offline, I can send you some more stuff.
I love it.
And some programs, some weddings that I've done, just to give you the outline of how to let that, so that it moves smoothly.
Okay. All right. I will take your advice and then some. Parting words for all of our listeners out there who really, you know, they maybe have found their community, want to start building this allyship. Is there that one place where you would ask people to start to get their voice out there to make a difference?
One place? No, there isn't one place. I say, you know, we need to be everywhere.
Yeah.
We need to be everywhere. So wherever that place is that you can affect change, by all means, do it.
There it is.
And do it passionately.
What does that mean to you, to do it passionately?
Well, for instance, you know, the interesting thing is that when I realized, once I was in seminary and I came up here because I was pastoring, oh, as a matter of fact, I was pastoring a church in Englewood, New Jersey. I don't know where in New Jersey you are.
I was born in Englewood, New Jersey.
Oh, okay. So Bethany Presbyterian.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's an African-American Presbyterian church, yeah. Well, okay, so that was the church I left to come up here. But one of the things in coming up here, I had to think of new ways to do ministry. Now, of course, I was involved with a church, the Memorial Church at Harvard with Reverend Peter Gomes. But I realized that many of my LGBT brothers and sisters were not at Harvard Divinity School or at church. And so I had to think of a way to, how do you reach beyond the boundaries really of church as well as the academy? And I realized that, okay, I needed to, and I had a background in journalism because when I graduated from undergrad, I worked at 17 Magazine. So sometimes you pull back from other careers and stuff, but I had decided I needed to talk about religion in a way, and not in a sermonic way,
right?
But certainly in a way in terms of informing the public of the role religion plays in discrimination against LGBTQ people. And why? Because homophobia is both the hatred of the other, and it is usually acted upon in the name of religion. So by reporting religion in the news, I aimed to really highlight how both religious intolerance and fundamentalism not only shatters the goal of American democracy, but also aids in perpetuating other forms of oppression,
yeah,
such as, you know, racism, classism, you know, sexism, anti-Semitism, and of course, homophobia.
Yeah, there it is. There it is. Listeners, this is what we need you to do. You need to stroll on over to IreneMonroe.com. And right there at IreneMonroe.com, you can access Reverend Irene Monroe's writing, online radio, video. I will tell you this. I'm so happy that this piece just popped up on my radar because I have been meaning to have you on the show for so many years now. I am so inspired by your authenticity of voice. I mean, certainly the power of your pen and the words that you put out there, both on paper and on radio, but there's such an authenticity and a drive and a calling to what you do. My hope is that you know just how inspiring it is. It really has supported me throughout much of my career, and I'm so appreciative.
Well, listen, I'm honored, and this is not the last of us connecting with each other, because I need to help you with this wedding.
Well, I will tell you, I'm going to say this on the air. I was going to tell you off the air. Not only do you need to help me with this wedding, but I already texted my partner a few hours ago and I said, this is the woman that I would like to perform our wedding. So we have a lot of chatting to do.
Oh, I'd be more than honored. Oh, my goodness.
It will be glorious. Reverend Irene Monroe, please, please keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you so much. And as they say, back at you.
It must have fallen out of a hole in your brown overcoat. They never said your name, but I knew just who they meant.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we have so much time left on this week's episode, so let's get to all of the latest LGBTQ news out there. Here I am at the time of this recording. It is day 4. Of the Republican National Convention, which is taking place in Cleveland, Ohio, which is where This Show Is So Gay is recorded. I am sitting here. People are like, oh, are you in a, you're in a suburb of Cleveland. Nobody actually lives in Cleveland. No, if you were to send me a piece of mail, you would address it to Cleveland, Ohio. I'm about, I would say, a mile and a half from downtown. I will finally be walking downtown today to check things out. My parents don't want me going anywhere near there. They're very nervous for my safety. And certainly I've heard a lot of reports that downtown, where I am with some frequency, is like a fortress right now. But I'm in Cleveland, Ohio. I want to check it out. I want to see Westboro Baptist Church in person. I've never seen them in person. But there's also an Eastboro Baptist Church. And it's these amazing activists who have these really positive, hilarious signs. So I'm just excited to go down there and check it out. There are so many LGBTQ narratives to this Republican National Convention. It's almost difficult to know where to start. And thus, I want to start in the most bizarre place, and that's with Third Eye Blind. Who would have thought that I would be talking about Third Eye Blind, that 90s band, but still going strong on This Show Is So Gay? Well, Third Eye Blind has used a performance near the site of the Republican National Convention to speak out on gay rights. A video posted on Twitter shows the rock band's lead singer, Stephen Jenkins, supporting LGBT rights and other issues during a charity show at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Another video shows him aggressively responding to boos. The band, not booze as in alcohol, but booze, B-O-O-S, as in how they booed Ted Cruz off the stage just last night. That was incredible. There's no LGBTQ angle to that. Well, I guess there's a slight one. At the beginning, he gave some sort of allusion to Orlando in not a great way. But yeah, incredible. I'm a politics junkie, by the way. I enjoy the politics. I'm a West Wing fanatic. So this is all, it's just incredible. It's all incredible. So anyway, back to Third Eye Blind. The band later answered a complaint from a Twitter user who said she was disappointed by replying, "Good." The show benefited Musicians on Call, a charity that brings bedside music to the sick. The band wrote on Twitter that it wasn't concerned about hurting the charity because they say it was well aware of who we are and our take on things like science and rights. You have to check out the video. They have a nice shout out to LGBT rights. And yeah, Third Eye Blind. Who would have thought? Third Eye Blind. Another person who is here this week, Caitlyn Jenner. She's here in Cleveland. Everybody is here in Cleveland this week. It's really quite incredible. Caitlyn Jenner has refused to give up on the Republican Party after the party adopted a new platform that is actively hostile to LGBT people. Jenner has been an outspoken Republican since before her transition to female and still supports the party, despite GOP lawmakers pushing anti-trans laws in dozens of states. Donald Trump recently reversed his stance to back North Carolina's anti-trans law, while the Republican National Convention, again, we talked about this last week, they adopted their most extreme party platform yet on LGBT rights. That platform, just to remind you all, it rejects attempts to ban gay cure therapy for minors, claiming parents should be free to make medical decisions about their children without interference. Also, that platform insists, quote, natural marriage between a man and a woman is most likely to result in offspring who do not become drug addicted or otherwise damaged. Well, despite all of this, it is not affecting Caitlyn Jenner. Not at all. Speaking at the LGBT-focused American Unity Fund event, she said this, quote, I want to help the Republican Party in so many ways. I think our best move to get back to a constitutional government is the Republican Party. I have to admit, I've been very disappointed, but I won't give up hope on it. I get it. The Democratic Party does a better job when it comes to the LGBT community and trans community, and Obama actually has been very good from that standpoint. But I think the Republican Party needs to understand they need to know people who are trans. There are trans people out in this audience right now, but you have no idea that they are trans. That's why I'm here, end quote. The former Olympian did criticize the party for its bathroom ban stance. She accused lawmakers of bullying trans people by pushing bathroom laws, joking that people are statistically more in danger of being sexually assaulted by GOP lawmakers in bathrooms than trans women. That's statistically true. Caitlyn Jenner said this, quote, maybe we should ban Republican representatives at the state level from being in bathrooms. You're creating laws for a non-issue. We don't have a problem here. There's not one single case of a trans bathroom assault. And she went on. She said this quote, "It was easy to come out as trans." So this, by the way, my listeners, this is the quote that is getting so many different people's attention. She said this, "It was easy to come out as trans. It was harder to come out as a Republican. But I have my beliefs and I want to share them. Maybe this is the reason God put me on this earth, to tell my story at this point in my life and in society, to live my life authentically and make a difference in the world." Let me read that first part again. It was easy to come out as trans. It was harder to come out as a Republican. Unsurprisingly, that has been met with a lot of derision. That has been met with a lot of skepticism, certainly, and it's been met with a lot of outrage. There are folks saying, what is this woman doing? What is this woman doing? So I will withhold judgment, but yeah, it was easier to come out as trans. It was harder to come out as a Republican. I don't know. I do not know about that one. More from here in Cleveland, the Republican National Convention. Yeah, Donald Trump came out on stage the other night, and he came out to Queen. That would be Freddie Mercury's voice. That is how he just kind of ascended a throne, or just really just walked out and he was backlit. It was the weirdest entrance, but people were very, very unhappy that he came out on stage to the music of Queen at this anti-LGBT Republican National Convention to play Queen. That's not cool. Well, one person who's not cool with that is Adam Lambert, who tours with Queen. Adam Lambert has torn into Donald Trump for blasting Queen songs at the Republican National Convention just days after Trump unveiled an extreme anti-LGBT choice for vice president. The Republican Party's platform, again, how many times can we say it? I like that it's in every news story. It's extremely anti-LGBT. So Governor Pence, you guys should know at this point, Governor Pence, really behind that Religious Freedom Protection Act in Indiana. It cost Indiana millions and millions and millions of dollars. And yeah, this is our vice presidential candidate on the Republican side. Given all of this, Governor Pence, and given this anti-LGBT platform, Queen fans were pretty outraged to hear Trump blasting the song "We Are the Champions" to the crowd after speaking at the RNC. Freddie Mercury. Does everybody know Freddie Mercury? I get nervous that maybe some of our younger listeners don't know Freddie Mercury as well as you should know Freddie Mercury. Freddie Mercury died of AIDS-related illness in 1991, and his death helped bring a focus to the illness that led to the very prevention funding that Mike Pence so enthusiastically tried to axe. That's what he did there in Indiana. He tried to strip AIDS-related research. He tried to strip HIV and AIDS-related support monies and channel them into conversion therapy. It was really quite terrible. Well, the surviving members of Queen confirmed that it was an unauthorized use at the Republican convention, and it was against their wishes. Adam Lambert, who has toured the world with the surviving members in tribute to Mercury, tore into the disrespectful act. He shared a photo that reads, quote, "If your political party spends decades treating gay people as second-class citizens, guess what? You don't get to use Freddie Mercury's music at your convention." There it is, in one sentence, one more time. If your political party spends decades treating gay people as second-class citizens, guess what? You don't get to use Freddie Mercury's music at your convention. Legendary Queen guitarist Brian May has also quietly signaled his dissatisfaction at this news. When Trump played the track previously, guitarist Brian May said, quote, "I can confirm that our permission to use the track was neither sought nor given. We are taking advice on what steps we can take to ensure that this does not continue. Regardless of our views on Mr. Trump's platform, it has always been against our policy to allow Queen music to be used as a political campaigning tool. Our music embodies our own dreams and beliefs, but it is for all who care to listen and enjoy." More people responding on Donald Trump's use of Queen music. California's Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, who he is a Democrat, he was among those to tear into Trump. He said, quote, "It's important to note that tonight's RNC convention ended with a song, We Are the Champions, sung by a gay man, Freddie Mercury. Freddie Mercury died of AIDS in 1991. His music was played at a convention where the most anti-LGBT policy platform was adopted just today. His music, which he famously labored over, which was intricate and complex was played at a convention where Mike Pence, a man who has spent his political career actively looking for opportunities to pass laws that would give others the legal framework to discriminate against LGBT people, sat comfortably in a VIP box. I'm not sure what Freddie Mercury would think of his music being played at the RNC convention, but I do know that if he weren't a famous rock star, he would have probably been greeted by a wall, a really high wall, because he represented everything that Mike Pence and Donald Trump are scared of. There you go. By the way, this does continue Donald Trump's record of being sued by he hasn't been sued yet by Queen, but maybe they're going to take action. He's been sued by a string of musicians in the past for using their music without permission. So there's Donald Trump and Freddie Mercury and Queen music. Ben Carson. By the way, it just keeps going. Right here in Cleveland, Ohio, where I sit, it keeps going with the RNC. Failed presidential candidate Dr. Ben Carson. In an interview now, he's compared transgender people to racists, saying they don't make sense. Ben Carson is comparing trans people to racists. Not Donald Trump, but trans people. The former neurosurgeon, Fox News pundit, and failed Republican presidential wannabe, he made the bizarre comments in an interview with The Hill. In the interview, he compared trans people to people who put on a fake accent and pretend to be from Afghanistan, which I didn't even know that people do that. He said this, quote, "For someone to wake up and think that they belong to a different sex because they feel different that day is the same as if you woke up and said, I'm Afghani today because I saw a movie about that last night. And even though my genetics might not indicate that, that's the way I feel. And if you say I'm not, then you're a racist. It's the same kind of situation. What we ought to do is utilize our brains, utilize our common sense as human beings. We've known what men are and what women are for thousands of years, so we don't know anything. Everything is relative. That doesn't make any sense. It's not based on your feelings. It's based on who you are. Can a leopard change its spots? No, it can't, because it feels like maybe it's a different creature. No, it's still a leopard. Sorry." That is Dr. Ben Carson. By the way, key word there, doctor. He's a doctor. This is a doctor. This is something a doctor is saying. It's unbelievable. There are all kinds of doctors out there. Do some research before you choose a doctor, because your doctor might be someone like Ben Carson. That would not work for you. My LGBTQ listeners, allies, probably wouldn't work for you either. There you go. This is all at the RNC. I am going to go down in a couple hours. I'm going to go check it out. I'm sure I'm going to talk about it on next week's show. I'll take some pictures. I'll put it up on Twitter. Our handle is This Show Is So Gay. We've been tweeting. By the way, a lot of drama on Twitter. Have you all been following all the drama on Twitter? Right-wing gay... You know, I'm reading a story right now that calls him an activist. I really struggle to call him an activist. But who I'm talking about is Milo Yiannopoulos. So, Milo, who used to go by the Twitter handle Nero, he no longer goes by the Twitter handle Nero because he has been banned by Twitter. He has been banned by Twitter for his blatantly hateful activity on Twitter in what the New York Times called, quote, one of the most egregious and consistent offenders of its terms of service. The right-wing gay supporter of Donald Trump, who is here, right here in Cleveland, a mile away, right this second, he has orchestrated and organized a racist campaign. This is what he did. He orchestrated and organized a racist campaign against actress Leslie Jones. Leslie Jones, who's on Saturday Night Live, she's in the all-female reboot of Ghostbusters. She is hilarious. She has borne the brunt of the racist and sexist tweets hurled at the film's stars and their director, so vicious that she quit Twitter this week after a vain attempt to report the mostly anonymous attackers. Yiannopoulos, who attended a Gays for Donald Trump cocktail party right here in Cleveland following the announcement of his Twitter ban, he called the Republican presidential nominee the most pro-gay candidate in history. Which, by the way, is just not true. Donald Trump, who said back in February that he wants to, this is a quote from him, "I'll overturn the shocking gay marriage decision, trust me." So no, Donald Trump is not one of the best, if not the best, pro-gay Republican candidates to ever run for the presidency. That is not true, Milo. But back to Milo. The conservative editor denounced the gay rights movement for fixating on transgender bathroom issues at the expense of combating an existential threat from Islam. This is what a spokesperson for Twitter said in a statement. Quote, "People should be able to express diverse opinions and beliefs on Twitter, but no one deserves to be subjected to targeted abuse online, and our rules prohibit inciting or engaging in the targeted abuse or harassment of others. We've seen an uptick in the number of accounts violating these policies and have taken enforcement action against these accounts, ranging from warnings that also require the deletion of tweets violating our policies to permanent suspension." Well, Yiannopoulos told the Times, quote, "This is the beginning of the end for Twitter." This guy, by the way, this guy's hubris is unbelievable. "This is the beginning of the end for Twitter. Some people are going to find this perfectly acceptable. Anyone who believes in free speech or is a conservative certainly will not." Whew. So he just keeps going. He said this, quote, "I've come here," that he went to Orlando, and this is what he said in Orlando, "I've come here to give you a warning from Europe. I'm going to Sweden, and in Sweden, which has the humiliating distinction of being the rape capital of Europe, thanks to Islamic immigration, where Islamic immigration isn't just hurting gays as it did in Orlando, I will be leading a gay pride march through the Muslim ghetto." This guy, I'm sorry, I don't think this is a good guy. I don't really think, this is my opinion, I don't think some of these gay conservatives really do believe what they're saying. They know that it endears them to a large portion of the community that they can't access. And the competition is not very fierce when you are putting out gay conservative ideologies for getting some attention, because there are very few of them. And so some of these folks, and I said this on a show a few weeks ago, are saying such outrageous things, and it's really difficult to believe that they believe everything they're saying. But all the conservatives out there who get to say now, hey, look, we have a gay. I have a gay best friend now, too. We have a gay on our side. See, we're not as bad people as everybody is saying. And so these folks, these gay conservatives, I'm not saying all of them, but some of them get attention they never would have received otherwise. So they are not competing with the wide range of voices, and we love that there is a wide range of voices on the liberal LGBTQ spectrum, right? Because there's so many voices out there, and you have to create some distinction, which I will remind you, be authentic. That's how you distinguish yourself from everybody else. I'm not trying to be anybody else. I'm doing what I do here. It's what we've done for 8 years on this show. But these folks, the competition to get your voice out there is a lot less. And so they get that attention. And I don't believe that all of these gay conservatives really believe everything they're saying. And Milo is in that camp. He gets a ton of attention. We have all these people who are hashtagging Free Milo, as if he is in any way being restricted. People say it's a First Amendment issue. It is not a First Amendment issue. The First Amendment does not protect you from being abusive. That's not what the First Amendment does at all. You don't get to just go on Twitter and abuse other people and be a bully and say hateful, hateful, racist things and say, no, 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 the First Amendment, you can't ban me. So one less voice on Twitter. I'm okay with it. Hopefully other people drop out too who are bullying other people. It's not good. One more story for you. Tristan Cejas took his own life after months of physical and verbal abuse while his grieving father of this boy who committed suicide after he was bullied by classmates for being gay. He is now, this father, suing the school for failing to protect his son. So Tristan took his life in February of 2015 after fellow pupils at Lincoln Park Middle School made his life a living hell due to perceived sexual orientation. Todd Cejas from Minnesota claims in his lawsuit that the district school board and former and current administrators failed to properly address the bullying of his son. The lack of response by the district accounted to discrimination against the young boy because of his perceived sexual orientation or gender expression. That's all in the lawsuit. Tristan Cejas was regularly called names, including freak. He was told he looks like a girl, and he was forced into the lockers. While the teen did not identify as gay, his father says he didn't conform to traditional stereotypes of masculinity. As well as damages, the suit is also seeking to ensure such incidents do not reoccur through training programs on homophobia and diversity. That's a great thing. Lori Peterson, who is the attorney for Todd Cihas, told a newspaper, quote, "This should never happen, let alone to kids who are forced to interact with their tormentors in school every day. We hope that we will be able to make a difference for other kids through bringing this action." According to his obituary, the teen will be remembered for his warm smile, generosity, courage, wit, and loving heart. Again, warm smile, generosity, courage, wit, and loving heart. That's how we want to remember him. So, yeah, a lawsuit here in Minnesota that's trying to change district policy. And it's just so incredibly, incredibly sad that this is what it takes to change some policy. It takes the tragic death of a teenager, but it is so important that schools be supportive. This is research-based. This isn't just this anecdote of this one tragedy. It's research-based. GLSEN puts out stats all the time. The more your school staff and the more that your teachers are trained, the more safe your LGBTQ students, gender nonconforming students, students who are perceived as gay, the more those students say, hey, my school feels safer. This is not an anecdote, though clearly, anecdotally, it's true as well. It is research-based. If you are in a place that has a school, which is all of us, reach out to your local school officials and ask, what kind of training are you offering your teachers and your school staff? Do it. That's something all of us can do. I know we're always looking for what kind of action can we take? What kind of action can we take? Well, this is one action that you can take. Reach out to your school. Provide a link to the GLSEN data. Just go to glsen.org. The school climate survey is right there. It is undeniable that students who are in a school where the teachers and staff are trained report feeling safer. And when they feel safer, they are astronomically more retained. Their grades go up. They show up for school more. This is something that all of you can do. You got to get out there. You have to use your voice to do something. Do something. So our huge, huge thanks to the Reverend Irene Monroe. Check out her piece in The Advocate imploring the white LGBTQ community to lift up our voices and help our brothers and sisters of color. They are asking for us to do everything that we can do, and we should be doing it. We don't need people to ask us. This is just what we should be doing. There is so much work to be done. She is doing incredible things with her voice, both on the radio, in the pulpit, with her pen. Great stuff. Go check out IreneMonroe.com. That's it for us this week. I will report back next week about all of my adventures that I will have today at the Republican National Convention. You guys, get out there. Go use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBTQ brothers and sisters. And while you're out there using your voice, while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay? Told the soul.